I decided to write this book called Beyond Distraction because there were two particular discourses that I found quite fascinating and very practical in the middle-length discourses, Sutta number 19 and 20. Sutta number 19 is on two kinds of thought, and it basically encourages practitioners to classify their thoughts as either helpful or harmful, beneficial or unbeneficial, what's called kusala in Pali or akusala, most commonly translated as wholesome and unwholesome. And we have lots of thoughts, and thoughts are important. We can't get through a day, we can't get through life without having thoughts. And thoughts are great, it's important. Even the Dharma path involves training the mind to wisely reflect, to give attention in a skillful way to experience, to understand and to comprehend the Dhamma and what's happening. Thinking is very important, but sometimes our thoughts actually sabotage our capacity to meet our goals, not only in meditation, but very often in life. So it becomes very important to develop a range of skills and competency with working with the thoughts in our own minds. Because if we don't give them attention, then habitual patterns will just get stronger and stronger, and we'll find that we're making the same mistakes over and over again in the way that we use our own minds. So in meditation practice and mindfulness practices, we are not only mindful of the body sitting and breathing, but we work with the conditions and tendencies and activities of the mind. And thinking is one big activity that occurs in our mind-body experience. In the two kinds of thought discourse, the Buddha said, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of one's own mind. And that's a powerful teaching. If you contemplate that, whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. That itself, I think, motivates somebody to want to look carefully at the mind. What are the thoughts? What direction are they going? Are they supporting our path? We can be driving down the freeway thinking about all kinds of crazy things. We could go for a hike in a beautiful forest and not even notice where we're walking, or the smells, or the birds, or the animals that share that walk with us because we're so obsessed with something in our own minds. We can do all kinds of activities lost in thought, and in a way, live in a fantasy world, removed from the mindful experience, and restrict our capacity to respond in a genuine, mindful, present, alive, vital way to life. Thoughts that are unwholesome very often are very painful, and we end up regretting the moments that we spent deepening them. Because each time we repeat a particular pattern, it's almost like we're deepening that groove in the mind. We're feeding that particular pattern. And each time we shift to something more wholesome, or we're mindful, which is a very wholesome state, we're strengthening that capacity to let go of distractions and to orient ourselves to what is of true value in our lives. It seems to me that these days people are extremely distracted, and it may be that it may be that we've always been distracted because the teachings that I find so useful are 26,000 years old. So even before people had telephones in their pockets all day long, before there was texting and before there were all these technical distractions, people were still distracted. So maybe it's always been that way, but it does feel to me that that this world has ever more. It seems like every year there's more distractions and distractions and distractions tugging at the attention. And we may need to be very diligent about How we use devices, how frequently we check email, how frequently we check for texts. And we might need to actually sort of separate a bit at certain times, like in retreats, so that we're not impacted and overwhelmed by the diversity of distractions in our ordinary lives that all get interwoven with our identity and our sense of responsibility. And sometimes take a little time away just to see what the habits are of the mind. And so retreats can be very valuable. But we don't have to go on retreat to see what's happening in our minds. We just sit down for a few minutes and ask the mind to do something very simple, like hear sounds arising and passing. And how long does it take before the mind was lost in thought? Sometimes not very long at all. Or we ask the mind to say, okay, I'm going to give you a very simple task now. Just feel the breath for 10 breaths. And sometimes the mind can't get past 2, can never get to 10 because it's lost in thought. So we can work with these strategies just in our ordinary lives. We don't need to necessarily be in a deep retreat to benefit from these strategies. But I think deep retreats are really where we see the with the support of the stillness and the support of the continuity of mindfulness, we can go very deep into what's happening in our minds. But this statement, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will be the inclination of the mind, to me is quite inspirational. I want to direct my mind towards what is good and useful. I don't want to fritter away this precious life thinking useless thoughts. And so motivated by that wish to be fully present and live my life fully, I look at the mind, I watch the mind, and we can all work with our minds in our daily activities as well as during meditation. Now, once we've recognized this thought is helpful and this thought is hurtful, you know, perhaps made two piles, or as the Buddha said, put them in two classes, then we can take the pile of the unwholesome thoughts, the harmful patterns, and pick out a couple of them to work with more diligently. And that's when we shift to the second sutta, which is called the removal of distracting thoughts, discourse number 20 in the Middle Link Discourses. And in this discourse, the Buddha gives us a sequence of 5 strategies to overcome and dispel habitual, unwholesome thoughts. So we don't do these in every sitting, and we don't do these with every deluded thought that floats past our minds. We work with them when we realize, oh my God, my mind is just obsessed with that worry. Or, oh dear, that particular planning just keeps going on and on. My goodness, I've planned what I'm going to pack for my trip now 20,000 times, and it's time to let it go. So, you know, whatever it is that you realize you have has really just become a habitual pattern, those are the ones that you go through the whole sequence with. Now, you might, with other thoughts, you might pick up one strategy here or there, but this whole training sequence actually can be very powerful to dispel deeply habituated thought patterns and, in a way, transform the way that we use our minds. This discourse on the removal of distracting thoughts was given in the context of developing what is called the higher mind, which implies deep concentration and samadhi states. It implies cultivating the conditions for insight, developing the awakening factors, developing really all the good qualities of the mind, in particular mindfulness, balanced energy, and concentration, so that we're primed for insight and understanding. So it's oriented in a way towards the deepening of concentration, but the context is liberating the mind. So it's very applicable to insight practice. The first strategy is to replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome one. And the Buddha used similes for all of these strategies, which make it very easy to kind of get a sense of the strategy. And this is like, you imagine you have a block of wood with a wood peg lodged inside. He says you can take a smaller peg and use it to dislodge the larger peg. And that smaller peg, because it's smaller, is not going to stay stuck in the mind. So you use a wholesome thought and you replace that unwholesome thought with a wholesome one. You use the wholesome one, the beneficial thought, to dislodge the unwholesome one, but then you don't cling to the wholesome one either. And the easiest example to work with this is to think when you see somebody who you have anger towards, replace that anger that will tend to find fault in everything that they do. Replace that angry thought with a thought of loving kindness or a thought of appreciation for something you value in them. So we make a shift. And that does more in the mind than to just deal with that particular angry situation. It tells you you're not stuck in anger. You can change the course of your thoughts because you just did. Even if it only lasted for a few moments, if you can change that thought pattern for just a few moments, that tells you you can work with this. It's quite possible. You don't have to be stuck in that pattern. It doesn't need to obsess your mind. But you might have to develop it. You might have to replace it several times. You might have to work fairly diligently with this. So that replacing develops a flexibility in the mind, a non-attachment to our own thought patterns. And so very often, this is all we need to do. We replace the thought. Now the mind is in a kind of a better state, a wholesome state, and we continue with our meditation practice, or we continue the activity that we're doing. And the mind has learned that it doesn't have to go down that path. It doesn't need to be stuck there. But there still may be some thoughts that continue to repeat the same thought pattern, and replacing it just didn't actually do the trick. The Buddha acknowledges that. And he says the second strategy is to examine the danger in those thoughts. And we examine the danger in the thoughts because very often we don't recognize that what benefit we think we're getting from the thoughts. Sometimes we have unwholesome habits and we keep repeating the unwholesome pattern because we are actually kind of getting something out of it. There's some feeling of personal reward or gratification. Maybe we like the power of being angry. Maybe we think that we need that to feel strong, or there's a sense of conceit in a particular thought pattern, and that's boosting our egos in an unwholesome way, but nevertheless in a gratifying way. There can be different things. Maybe it's reinforcing a sense of an attachment to a viewer opinion, might be reinforcing a sense of a belonging to a group or identity. So we have to see that there what the gratification is, and then honestly contemplate, where is this leading? If I frequently think thoughts of anger, what is that actually leading to? And is that my goal in life? Is that my aim? Is that where I want to be? So, and that can instill a sense of dispassion and non-attachment and motivation to let go of the unwholesome pattern. When we recognize the danger in the second strategy, if we need to apply the third strategy, it sometimes kind of comes right on the heels of it. The third strategy is to avoid it, ignore it. Kind of forget about it. And some people will think, aren't I supposed to turn my attention toward it and be mindful of it? Well, sometimes when we give attention to a pattern, just that attention feeds it. And so if you find that even after trying an antidote and replacing it with a wholesome thought, and you've contemplated and recognized the dangers, that the mind is still going into the field of that danger, then it's good to intentionally withdraw the attention from it, pull the energy away from it. Try to forget it. You know, maybe if it's a grudge or a resentment, just forget it. Just forget it. If it's something about the past, know that the past is gone. If it's something about the future, know that it hasn't happened yet. Give yourself a break to just pull that attention away. That's a very important skill, is not only to be able to move towards something, but to also be able to settle away from it. This is not aversion to it, and it's not fear of it. It's recognizing that we have the capacity to give our attention to something, to, for example, see something, and then to turn our attention away from something. We don't need to be just pulled into whatever arises in that moment. We're gaining some kind of influence and control. We're able to actively work with and guide the development of our minds when we're able to determine what we give attention to and what we don't give attention to. The next strategy, the fourth strategy, is called investigating, stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, which is kind of a confusing series of words in English, but it basically means we need to understand the causes. We get lost in the stories so often, and we're trapped in that energy too often. And if we've already tried these initial strategies that shift, that shift our energy and pull our attention away, and we're still getting pulled into those thoughts, it's time to look deeper. It's time to investigate. What's so seductive there? What's happening? What, where, why, how is the mind still getting fuel to keep thinking those thoughts? And we have to look deeper than the superficial story or the initial sense that the mind is thinking, and look deeper at the interaction between thoughts and emotions, the sensations that arise, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, the attitude we have toward it, the assumptions we make about those thoughts, and who we think we are when we're involved in that thought pattern. Sort of what are the underlying triggers, and what are the underlying forces that keep us going down that groove, keep us going down that channel, that path of unwholesome thought patterns. So we're looking deeper than just the content or just the fact of thinking. We're looking deeper at the emotions, and then we're looking at what makes that emotion, what feeds that, and then what feeds that, and we look deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. We need to understand not just what type of thought has arisen. We need to understand the conditioning that continues to fuel that pattern. Very often, this investigation leads us to understand and recognize how we're building a certain view of who we are through those thought patterns. Whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, often there's a sense of self, a particular sense of self that we're protecting or reinforcing underneath whatever obsession we have. And so we do a little investigation. This is a skillful use of thought to investigate thought. But so now that we understand those thoughts, very often the wisdom that comes from understanding them reinforces and actually it takes away whatever fuel is still being, drawn in, is still being used in that pattern. So very often, once we understand it, it seems to not arise again. And we can continue with our task or our meditation practice or whatever we were doing. Wisdom is powerful. especially powerful if it's arisen after we've developed some flexibility of the mind, after we've already made a commitment to ourselves to not go down that pattern because we see the danger, when we realize that our attention fuels experience so that we can pull our attention away and again develop some flexibility of mind there. And now we can understand the deep inner dynamics that keep us locked into certain patterns that are not supporting our lives. I find that these first four strategies are almost always sufficient. But, there are a few thoughts that will still obsess the mind. You know, they either trigger something very deep in us, or we've just practiced them a really long time and we've made that groove very deep. And so sometimes we have to add an additional strategy, which is the fifth strategy that the Buddha suggested. And this is determination and resolve. And so we bring in a very strong energy. One with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned and subside. With the abandoning of them, the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. There's quite a strength in that, isn't there? The simile sounds a little violent, where he compares it to a strong man seizing a weaker man by the shoulders and beating him down, constraining him and crushing him. It sounds a little violent, but this is not a violent act, because at this point in the series, we're not doing it out of aversion. We've already developed the wisdom. But nevertheless, the pattern still arises. So it's not self-hate, it's not self-criticism, it's not self-flagellation. We're just recognizing that we need an oomph. We need to really bring forth a strength of determination, a strength of commitment, and trust that our virtues and our discipline and our wholesome capacities are stronger than our defilements. That our mindfulness, that our commitment to freedom are all stronger than the defilements that keep feeding that pattern. And so we trust that strength of our commitment to be mindful, of our commitment to free the mind from greed, hate, and delusion, our commitment to develop the Dhamma path. And it's that strength, not anger at ourselves for having that thought, not aversion to the thought, but a recognition of the strength of our capacity to develop our own minds. And we bring forth that strength and add that as a strategy. And that's like, I call it saying no and meaning it. You know, the thought keeps arising, we recognize the thought, and we say no more to it. I am not going to think that angry thought one more time. My life is more important than that. I am not going to keep giving my time and my life energy to greed or hate or even delusion. I am just not going to do it. I see how it's happening in this situation, and I'm saying no more to it. The trick is actually meaning it, because sometimes we say no, but then we think, well, you know, maybe. You know, I'm getting some benefit from that, you know. It kind of helps me fit into my family. They all talk like that. They all think like that. Then I can agree with them and I'm one of them. Or, it makes me feel really powerful. Or, whatever our excuse is, whatever our attachment is. Because we wouldn't be having any repeated thought if we weren't attached. The wisdom step, the fourth step of understanding the underlying causes, needs to go deep enough that we see the dynamic. And that then there's no aversion, no anger towards it, because there's understanding of how the mind is caught by that defilement. And then that understanding shows us the need for a kind of strategic energy, a commitment that can dispel it, because we're standing in our virtues. So we must take this fifth step as a last resort kind of practice, only when the other ones haven't worked, and we do so standing upon wisdom, standing upon understanding, not self-hate or anger. So these five strategies I have found are very effective for dispelling distracting thoughts in meditation and in ordinary life. And most of them are dispelled in the very first strategy or two. And most thoughts, for that matter, just recognizing that they're a thought and that it's just a thought, it's nothing more than that, takes most of their power away. But even the big thoughts, even the ones that we're more deeply attached to, will be dispelled by the initial strategies. And so the Buddha gives these as a sequence. If somebody tries to jump to strategy five before they've done the earlier steps, very often it's just self-hate. You know, they feel beaten up by it. There's judgment there, self-judgment, because they haven't done the lower stages. So it's important to work with them in sequence. It's important to have a sense that each one creates the conditions for the later steps. And in this way, we can really purify our minds and free our minds from really any kind of unwholesome pattern. We definitely don't need to live as a slave to our own thoughts. This discourse, the number 20, the removal of distracting thoughts, also included a sentence that I found very inspiring that I'll close with. It says, "One is then called a master." "One is then called a master of the courses of thought. One will think whatever thought one wishes to think, and one will not think any thought that one does not wish to think." Very powerful, very powerful. In the Pali version, it continues, "One has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, one has made an end of suffering." So this possibility of being a master of our own mind, I don't know, that inspired me early in my practice to realize that there's a lot in the world that is out of my control, but nobody can say that my mind is out of my control. Only when I don't work with it. I have the capacity to guide and direct and to develop my mind. It may not instantly be perfect, whatever perfect in a mind might be, but I certainly can guide and direct my mind away from unwholesome habits and toward habits that I respect and that support this path of awakening that lead to the end of greed, hate, and delusion. And I do feel very strongly that we all have this capacity to improve the conditions of our own minds, and that by improving the conditions of our own minds, we improve the clarity of our action, the kindness of our speech, and it reveals the way to the ultimate release, the ultimate aim of the Buddhist teachings, which is liberation, freedom, the ending of greed, hate, and delusion. So with that, I would like to take a few minutes to respond to any comments or questions you might have, either about